Hello, and welcome to Learning from Nature, the Biomimicry Podcast with me, your host, Lily Ehrman. Happy 2023, and thanks for tuning in. I am overjoyed to be back after a few months off and can't wait to share lots more biomimicry inspiration with you all. This new series of episodes is going to be centered around function in nature. We will be exploring the wide range of incredible and interesting strategies that organisms have for a variety of functions, like creating color, building, moving, and attaching, just to name a few. Today, we will be kicking it off with one of my all-time favorite biomimicry sheroes and an absolute force of nature, Dr. Dana Baumeister. We will lay the groundwork for what function is and why it's important in biomimicry. Here's a quick introduction for Dana, although it's not that quick since she's been a changemaker in this space for decades, and I want to make sure her accomplishments and impact are not cut short. Dr. Dana Baumeister is the co-founder of Biomimicry 3.8. With a devotion to applied natural history and a passion for sharing the genius of nature, Dana has worked in the field of biomimicry with business partner Janine Benya since 1998, traveling the world as a biomimicry thought leader, business consultant, and professor. Together, they founded the Biomimicry Guild Consulting Practice, the Biomimicry Institute 501c3, and in 2010, Biomimicry 3.8, a B Corp social enterprise that helps clients find innovation inspired by nature and offers the highest level of biomimicry training to professionals worldwide. Dana's foundational work has been critical to the biomimicry movement, establishing it as a fresh and innovative practice, as well as a philosophy to meet the world's sustainability challenges. As an educator, researcher, and design consultant, Dana has helped more than 100 companies consult the natural world for elegant and sustainable design solutions, including Microsoft, Nike, Interface, General Mills, Boeing, Herman Miller, Kohler, Seventh Generation, and Procter & Gamble. Dana is known for her engaging presentations and her ability to empower others to use biomimicry in every aspect of their work. She has been a featured speaker at the National Science Foundation, World Expo, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Bioneers, Gen Biz, South by Southwest, and countless other events. In 2008, Dana designed and continues to teach the world's first certified biomimicry professional program, an in-person two-year master-level course that trains, certifies, and connects biomimicry professionals with practitioners worldwide. She also co-designed the Biomimicry Specialist Program. Both programs are creating a new kind of professional who can employ the practice of biomimicry at its highest level. Due to the overwhelming success of these programs, Biomimicry 3.8 and Arizona State University partnered in 2015 to create an online graduate certificate program and the world's first Master of Science in Biomimicry. Dana serves as a co-director of ASU's Biomimicry Center, the director of the graduate programs, and a professor of practice in the School of Complex Adaptive Systems at ASU. She is also a regular guest instructor for the Harvard Executive Education in Sustainability Leadership. Dana is the senior editor of Biomimicry Resource Handbook, a seed bank of knowledge and best practices, where she compiled more than a decade's worth of practical biomimicry experience into one comprehensive biomimicry handbook, which serves as the key textbook for the MS in Biomimicry program at ASU. She also serves on the board of Biomimicry for Social Innovation and is a Dana Meadows Fellow of the Sustainability Institute. It is with great pleasure that I get to chat with Dana, so I won't delay any longer. This is a juicy one, so I hope you get to enjoy listening on your walk in nature, your commute, or at the kitchen table. Let's jump on in. Also, a brief side note. I apologize in advance for some funky audio in this episode. There was a little echo on my end, and after a few minutes of trying to figure out where it was coming from, we just decided to forge onward. One day, I'll be a tech pro and this won't happen, but for now, we are embracing the journey and accepting what we cannot change. Anyway, thanks for your understanding on this. I appreciate you all so much. Welcome, Dr. Baumeister. I'm so excited to talk to you today and have you share more about your experience in biomimicry, what biomimicry is, and especially what function is. So this new series is all about function in nature and why it's so important in biomimicry. This is going to be a really great introduction to that. So Dr. Baumeister, would you please introduce yourself?
Well, happy to be here. Thanks for having me today, Lily. Yes, I am Dr. Baumeister, although Dana works just fine. I have been working in biomimicry now for 25 years, and I am a co-founder of Biomimicry 3.8. I'm one of the co-founders of the Biomimicry Institute, as well as a co-founder of the Biomimicry Center and professor of practice at Arizona State University. I'm not currently involved with the Institute, but still heavily involved, and both working in the practice of biomimicry through Biomimicry 3.8 and in the education side through Arizona State University.
Amazing. And so happy to talk with you today about your experiences, especially the work with the consulting firm and maybe getting into some of those projects that are great examples of how biomimicry is done. So the first question I have for you is, how do you define biomimicry? We've talked a lot about this in the podcast in previous episodes, but just for folks joining today, your definition.
Well, when I'm on stage, I describe biomimicry as the conscious emulation of nature's genius, which is by design looking at making a choice to actively turn towards some of the other 30 million species on the planet and ask the question of how do you do this? How do you do what we're trying to do? So there's a conscious choice to do that. And emulating is a really important part of it because we're not directly copying, but actually pulling out the design lessons, the design principles, the nuance, the essence of what is actually part of that lesson from nature. And then genius is nature's genius is based on the premise of, well, you know, she's been around for 3.8 billion years and we're relative newcomers. We only have a 300,000 year history, and it makes sense to ask our elders for a little bit of advice on how to live here well. And so now as we work in the practice of biomimicry, it's really ultimately about applying those lessons to help bring about a more regenerative world, you know, where we're humans and the rest of life, it can really flourish. And so that's the work that we bring the practice of biomimicry to, because in our minds, you ultimately have to have not just that emulation piece, but a very, very strong, what we call reconnect piece. We're recognizing that humans are part of nature, we mm-hmm. are nature, as well as an ethos. Like, where are you going to apply these lessons? Are you going to use it to build a better nuclear warhead? Probably not. I don't think nature would approve. So those foundational pieces are key to what it means to practice biomimicry.
Getting into kind of your background and your involvement in biomimicry now, how did you first find and fall in love with the practice of biomimicry?
So I am a biologist by training, and I did my undergraduate studies in environmental biology, actually tropical marine biology, but I kept drifting over in the art department, and I got a second major in art design and also in chemistry. And so I knew I was always interested in the intersection between the left brain and right brain, but I wanted to put that to good practice. I didn't want to just, you know, create scientific illustrations. I wanted mm-hmm. to put my love for nature to good work. And so I did a master's in resource conservation for that purpose, but I discovered that the science was actually really crappy. It was more political than it was based on science. And so that didn't really work for me as well. And so then I decided I wanted to do a master's, sort of called the first one my accidental master's. I wanted to do a real master's where I could design a wall that breathed like skin. And so I looked around and I asked questions. And of course, every university I contacted or faculty, they were like, what? what are you talking about? That, you know, I would call architecture schools and they're like, no, we don't do that. And so I really had no home for that idea. But I was fascinated by the idea of, you know, if you look at our skin, it provides so many more functions mm-hmm. than a wall, which is relatively crude design. And of course, this was, you know, more than 25 years ago, so designs were even cruder back then. And I, you know, the elegance of our human skin or polar bear fur or anything, I thought, man, we could do better. But then because I could find no outlet for that curiosity, I ended up going back and getting a doctorate in organismic biology because I still had that fundamental love of pure biology. And I kept drifting over, in this case, to the environmental studies department. This was before sustainability was even a word. And there, of course, I loved the ethos that was behind it, but there was kind of no science, right? It was all heart and passion and no science. And that didn't really work for me either, but I was in a class in the environmental studies department one day, and a professor mentioned this book that had just come out called Biomimicry and explained what it was about. And I was like, oh my God, there's my wall that breathes like skin. And so I literally got up in the middle of his class, walked down, found the bookstore, got the book, sat down. I read it in one sitting. It was like 17 hours. And I said, this is exactly what I want to do. And I was so thrilled to discover it and find it. Of course, this was Janine Benyus's book, Biomimicry, Innovation Inspired by Nature. And so this was about 3 months after the book had been published. So it was January of 98. And I shook for days because I was like, I found my home. And then I went back to the professor. I said, tell me more. And he's like, well, I don't know. But, you know, the author lives a half an hour down the road. You know, and of course, in Montana, nobody lives a half an hour down the road. There's just nobody living in Montana. So the serendipity of Janine being so close was pretty profound.
Yeah.
And so I called her up and I knew it was the most important phone call of my life. And she graciously invited me down, and I arrived at her house at noon and I left at 2 o'clock in the morning on our first meeting. So 14 hours, we were just like, blah, 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 blah. And I said, this is what I want to do. And she said, do what? And I was like, bring this to the world. And she's like, well, I'm a writer. Go ahead. And of course, the world didn't let Janine really write her next book. She's on sabbatical right now working on that next book. But we've been business partners now for the last 25 years, bringing biomimicry to the world.
That's incredible. That's such a serendipitous meeting that she was so close and then just sitting down and figuring it all out.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine like being at that precipice of like, what does this look like in the world? How do we bring this to light and bring this to more people, both in education and consulting, whatever that looked like?
It was, and we asked those questions. And of course, in the beginning, we thought all we had to do was just like point to it, right? Like,
yeah.
Look what others are doing, and that would be enough. And we discovered, you know, that wasn't enough. And so then it was like, okay, well, if we can't just point to it, you know, maybe we need to make the biology more accessible. And so then we developed programs to make the biology more accessible. When we created Ask Nature, you know, the database. And then we're like, okay, well, that's not enough. Then, you know, a few are doing it, but not enough. And now we have to stand on stage and we have to talk about how this works. And then we have to create the educational program so we can teach them how to do it. And then now we actually have to hold their hands and help them do it, you know? So it's really been a work in progress. And now, you know, the community is huge. Of people all around the world that we've trained, that we've worked with, and that are really bringing biomimicry in all its different facets to the world and helping develop the discipline. You know, it's of course an ancient practice. It's not it's not new to humanity, but we like to think of it as an emerging discipline of an ancient practice. And we've always asked nature for advice. We've just sort of forgotten in modernity to do so.
Yeah.
And so the discipline itself, of course, needs tools and frameworks and rubrics, and it needs a deep dive into, you know, how does it work in mechanical engineering? How does it work in chemistry? How does it work in design? And so, you know, developing both these generalized tools and then helping support people as they develop more specific tools and put them to work, put them to practice. So it's a constantly adapting and evolving, just as nature does, to figure out what's the context, what's the world in which we're applying this work, and how do we continue to make it relevant, all with a goal that we get back to remembering that connection and remembering this as a deep practice, and so that it's in our subconscious that we always ask nature for advice.
Yeah. And as somebody who teaches biomimicry now to undergrads, I'm grateful for you and Janine and the whole community of biomimicry for putting some of that framework into play, because it is so important when you go to teach others and spread this knowledge and get them practicing it in a deeper, meaningful way. Not just does it look like a leaf, but does it function like a leaf? That is that jump does take a lot for a lot of folks.
Yeah. And it takes it past the superficial, right? And
exactly.
And it actually creates the opportunity for really deep, innovative insights. And all of that methodology, all of that practice came from experience. It wasn't like, what would this look like? You know, it was not an academic endeavor at first. It very much, and that's why I am a professor of practice at ASU and why I've not given up my consulting work, you know, and just teaching. It's very important that I'm constantly figuring out what does this look like in the field and then how to translate that into something you can teach and learn so you can do it too.
That's a good segue, because my next question for you is, what do you currently do in the biomimicry field? You spoke to some of your roles, but as far as like the practitioner's program, the master's degree, and your consulting work.
Yeah, well, so at Biomimicry 3.8, we now have a staff of almost 30 people.
Wow.
Which is, there's a lot. And so that means we're juggling at any given time 10 to 15 different projects with clients. And so I play a role of both supporting the biomimics in the organization, you know, providing insights, providing support and direction, as well as constantly sort of exploring the territory of the next edge. You know, so for example, we're working on a project right now that we've got, you know, commitment for the funding, but we just haven't started it yet, or at least a verbal commitment of, yes, we want to do this, that's around applying biomimicry and social innovation and really seeing how we could learn from nature to rebuild trust in healthcare back in this country. So, you know, like those sorts of places are not the obvious of, how do I build a better wing that's like a bird? It gets much more nuanced. And so I'm doing a lot of that edge work, the learning edge work. And then, of course, at ASU, directing the master's degree program. And then one of my favorite projects is the Certified Biomimicry Professional Program. So we're in our sixth cohort. I started this in 2008, and over 2 years bring a small cohort of 16 to 20 individuals, working professionals that love biomimicry and helping cultivate and develop them as biomimicry leaders. And so, and we go to 6 different habitats around the world. And so I get the joy of like also continuing to learn as I go in all these new biomes, these new ecosystems, and then working with these individuals to develop their leadership capacity.
Such an awesome program. I have some friends in that program right now, and it just looks so fun. Maybe someday in the future, I'll be able to join.
I hope we see you. I hope we get to see you, Lily. Yes.
Dana, this is kind of the segue that I'd like for us to start focusing on function. So this whole new series, I'm going to be exploring different functions in nature. And I think this is a great conversation to start that off. I would like you to describe what function is in biomimicry.
Yeah. So function is getting at what becomes the most important. Well, I'm not going to say the most important. There's a lot of important ingredients to the process of biomimicry. But function allows us to create a bridge between what we're trying to solve for in the human design world and the questions and lessons that we're trying to garner from the more than human world. And it's a bridge. I call it the function bridge. And it's really asking the question of nature, not what are you, who are you, but rather what do you do, right? What is it that what are the practices, the strategies that you're engaged in that get and align with where we're trying to go? So, and it's about transforming your question often from what's a noun, you know, maybe you want to design a better light bulb. Well, that would be a ridiculous question to ask other species. But what you really want to do with that light bulb, the function you want to achieve with that light bulb, is to illuminate. So you're turning that noun into a verb. And then if you were to go over and cross that function bridge and go over and explore the world of nature and biology, and you could bring that question with you and say, well, how does nature illuminate? Now, suddenly, well, let me tell you about the Hawaiian bobtail squid. You know, let me tell you about this, you know, these really cool ferns in Ireland that glow in the dark, or the mushrooms that glow in the dark. Here we have a form of illumination. Let's talk about structural color and how light is reflected back. There's a form of illumination there. And so suddenly you have a whole bunch more possibilities. And so that idea of function, it allows us to, you know, not look like fools as students when we go and ask nature, but to actually open up the possibility for how we might learn some of those lessons. And it's not all that different than the first step of good design, you know, completely independent of where you get your ideas from. Good design should ultimately start with what are you trying to do, not what do you want your outcome to be,
right,
or your result to be, but what are you trying to do? And biomimicry just adds that extra nuance of, well, when you ask that question, go ask the more than human.
Exactly. I love that you use the word bridge. I think that's a really important kind of metaphor when we think about the biomimicry practice. And it's something I bring into my teaching of like, okay, we know we're exploring a challenge, or we're trying to figure out how, what do we want our design to accomplish? And that's how we rephrase the question, how does nature, with that verb in there, and then we can look to nature for solutions. And we had, I had Andrew Howley from Ask Nature on a couple episodes back, and we talked a lot about the biomimicry taxonomy. So I'd love for you to maybe expand on how folks can use the biomimicry taxonomy when they're just starting out and starting to think about function.
Oh, great. Yeah, I'm glad you met with Andrew. So yeah, the taxonomy actually was something that we began back in, oh, maybe like 2007, 2008. Because at the time we were putting together a book, we were going to call it Nature's 100 Best. And we were gathering all of these really cool biological stories. And we thought, how are we going to categorize them? How are we going to like cluster them? Mm-hmm. And how do we put them in a way that connects with architects or engineers, you know, how are they going to find that information? And we began to, you know, recognize that there were taxonomies for engineers and taxonomies for architects and taxonomies for industrial designers. And so we began to say, well, could we categorize all of these, that basically what we call the cutting room floor. You know, we had the 100 that were going to go in the book, but we had the 3,500 that weren't making it into the book. And so how do we put those in some order? And that's ultimately what became the foundation of Ask Nature as a database. And so we built the taxonomy, and it's had a couple of I'm not going to call them whole on total variations, but, you know, nuances and upgrades as mm-hmm. we've gotten a little bit more finessed. But we worked very hard to create different verbs that would be universally accessible no matter what your background is. So whether you were a designer or an engineer, architect, whatever it might be, or even, you know, even in business, even in social innovation, like what are these verbs that you can be like, yeah, okay, that kind of sounds like what I'm trying to do. And a biologist would be like, yeah, okay, I can make a case for nature doing that same verb, right? So that's that functional piece. So the beauty of Ask Nature is it is organized by that taxonomy. It's organized by those verbs. And for a first pass, when you're trying to like get oriented and figure out, how am I even going to begin to tap into this incredible reservoir of brilliance that nature has to offer? Then starting with the biomimicry taxonomy is a great place, and it helps you build some confidence into both identifying some verbs that get close to what you want to kind of aim for, and then the biology that's in the database behind it. I don't think it's the end all to be all, because, you know, it's pretty high level. And usually, like in our work in the consulting firm, we have a much more nuanced verb, a much more nuanced function that we ask when we're diving into a specific project. But of course, at Ask Nature, the database, you don't know who's showing up, who's logging mm-hmm. in, and where their challenge might be. So you have to stay high level. But the key for anybody who's working with this is recognizing it, that this is your door, this is your entry point. And then as you begin to unpack, you got to get a lot more nuanced in order to be even more relevant for the specific realm in which you're trying to apply the lessons.
Right. And I don't want to get too into the weeds here, but I also will mention something that kind of helped me clarify and is something that I talk to folks when I lead workshops and stuff. There's somewhat a set amount of functions out there in the world, but there are infinite strategies by which organisms accomplish those functions. And that's what the taxonomy showcases, the number of functions, and they have subgroups, you know, where you can get more specific and more specific. And I recommend folks look at the taxonomy, even just as an introduction to biomimicry, because it's a great kind of high level overview. Like you said, Dana, like, oh, this is where I'm going with this. This is what I want to look for. This is what I want to copy or to emulate. And we don't need to get into strategy right now, but maybe a segue to that could be this question I have around giving a few examples of function in nature and projects that you've worked on for 3.8 that have incorporated those functions.
Yeah. Yeah, I can speak to that. I don't have the taxonomy in front of me, so I can't show exactly the bridge between the more general form of the verb. Even in the third tier of what's in the taxonomy, those... the third tier gets at more of like contextual, like, so cooperation, you know, between species, cooperation among within a species, and you know, so it's sort of like yeah. additional context. But it may be that, you know, that there's a different kind of verb that you may want to choose, or different, more nuanced context. So when I think about a couple of projects that we've worked on, you know, like there's been a couple of product designs that were very, very interested in the question of the you know, wicking, right? So wicking does not show up on Ask Nature. But and wicking, of course, is the process of, mm-hmm. of moving moisture from one area to another area. And so even if in the world of having moisture, you can do a lot of things with moisture, right? You can evaporate it. You can condense it. You can move it. You can wick it. And sometimes you can manage it. You can freeze it. You can crystallize it. You can condense, you know, like there's so many things. And depending on your specific project, you might get more nuanced. So, for example, we worked with, and I have to be mindful of confidentiality agreements.
Right,
so I can't give names and too many specifics here because my clients have a lot more lawyers than we certainly do. you know, we worked on for one of the consumer product good companies, one of the big name brands, and they under the general realm of manage moisture, we did three different projects with three very different verbs. You know, very different functions depending on the specific project. So one was really trying to overcome the barrier that moisture only, you know, it goes into an equilibrium. So once you have you know, 50-50 on the inside and outside of a barrier, then moisture is going to stop, right? It's going to always go from wetter to drier. And then once those two balance out, the movement is stopped. And so if you have to, you basically are pushing moisture uphill against a gradient. So there was a lot of questions on that particular challenge that were about moving moisture through a barrier and then overcoming that natural inhibition to stop, you know, when there was an equilibrium. And that was really important for them because that, you know, those basic laws of physics meant that half of their product was staying in the product and it wasn't making it to its intended destination and therefore was just being disposed of. So that's a huge sustainability loss, right? You have to add all this product, but only half comes out. So, you know, that was another one. I had a different one that was about moisture. In this case, it was about how do we keep moisture out of, you know, a product that otherwise needed to stay dry. But so it was also a barrier question. But there's, you know, different nuances. This was actually in the food sector. So you got different requirements in different contexts of, you know, how you're managing these different phenomena. And that's why those nuanced verbs really make a difference. Right. And it's funny, water shows up in a lot of places. We also did a project in, you know, airlines. And in this case, it, you know, in planes, you don't realize this, but when you're up at 40,000 feet, all of that exhaled air is full of moisture from all the people. And so it, of course, rises in the plane because it's warm air, goes through the barriers of the plane and hits the inside of the outside skin, which is at 40,000 feet. And it's freezing. So then it freezes. But then you have the heat from the building, which melts it. And so then you got this water that needs to go somewhere. So trying to get at the right question, are we talking about ice nucleation? Are we talking, where do we intervene in this system? Are we intervening when it's still warm moisture? Are we intervening when it's liquid? Are we intervening when it's ice? Are we trying to prevent the ice crystallization? Because, of course, that does damage to materials. And so a big part of the project and the work in all of these is really spending time to understand what the challenge is, where you have the opportunity to intervene, so then you can fine-tune what that functional question will be. And then you can get into the nuance of, you know, how would nature solve that particular function?
And I'll just add here too, because I think it's important to mention how you've kind of hinted at this, but finding the right function and getting as nuanced as possible for your specific challenge and context is so important, because otherwise you're not going to find solutions that fit the challenge in a very simplistic way, right? So I guess in summary, I'd like for you to just kind of state why function is so important in biomimicry. And like the implications of finding a good function versus a non-relevant function.
Yeah. Well, you could spend a lot of time doing research going down the wrong path, right? If you haven't asked the right question. So function is critically important because, one, as I mentioned earlier, it gets you the ability to cross the bridge. It's like, I think of it as the password. You know, you don't get to cross that bridge over into asking nature for advice unless you have the password. And the password is that biologized question, which is that function. There's another password you need to come back over on the design side, which is the abstracted design principle, but that's a whole other topic. But so you need that password. So that's why it's critically important. And if you don't have the right password, you might find some really interesting information. Either A, it's not going to be relevant to the challenge, or what's more often the case, it's not a place where you can actually intervene in the challenge. Right? Maybe it's further upstream, or maybe it's further downstream, but it's kind of a, and so one of the things we always try to do is define, like, what are the negotiables and non-negotiables in this process, so we know where we can intervene. And it's interesting, like I've had a client where it was a packaging challenge. And the function in this case was resealable packaging. And, or, you know, that was the, sorry, not the function, but that was the output, what they wanted. And so we had to write a function that was around how does nature manage openings in a way that allows for closing and opening. It's kind of awkward the mm-hmm. way it's written. Because this case was really about actually keeping moisture out when it was closed, but dealing with the fact that, you know, Ziplocs in this case were getting full of detritus, which would prevent the seal, right? So the sealing was important. But it wasn't just maintaining a seal, it was being able to open and close a seal. And but so it was for packaging. And when they laid this out for me, they were like, yep, we want you to do it with the same materials and the same equipment at the same speed and end up costing less than a penny a package. You know, and I was like, you know, and I told them, I said, I'm sorry, you know, nature's not going to be able to solve your problem. And then their answer was, well, we've already gone through 42 other consultants and you're the last on the list. So give it a try. I was like, okay, don't know if it'll be flattered or otherwise. And so we did, and we went through this, and we came up with some really awesome ideas. And the beauty of this process is they then took the biology and the lessons, and they actually took them to packaging design students at a nearby university who came up with a number of design concepts, two of which they got patents on. And they realized, of course, that they had to let go of some of those non-negotiables. Mm-hmm. So some of the beauty of asking nature of what would you do can also help you ask the question of what shouldn't you do? And just like we might say, how might nature do this or what would nature do? We also want to ask the question of what would nature not do? Mm-hmm. And sometimes the not answer is as interesting as the positive answer, you know, the yes answer, and really helps companies rethink and set aside a lot of their assumptions when they're in this process. So function's incredibly powerful, and it's something that is simultaneously really easy once you get the hang of it and really difficult when you first get started, because we tend to overthink these things. Mm-hmm. But it's important to practice, and then your neurons start shifting in your brain where when you go out in nature, you're no longer asking, what is that? But what does it do? What is it doing?
Right? I love asking that question when I'm out hiking, because it garners so much more curiosity and deep diving than, oh, I know the name of this plant, or I know the name of that bird, so I'm done looking at it, or I'm done, you know, I've checked it off on my bird list, so I'm finished. It's like, oh, how does it communicate with its neighbors? Mm-hmm. How does it build its nests? What does it eat? What are its predators? What is its prey? There's so much more there. And then that starts the function conversation, right? Those are all functions. So it's like, how does it build? How does it communicate? And it's just so much more fun of an experience outside.
Exactly. And then the more you go, the more you start to see and recognize deep patterns. And you're like, oh, okay, so that's a deep pattern. And of course, we have our life's principles, the really deep, deep principles that apply to everyone. But you have deep patterns that are showing up over and over again. And what makes deep patterns interesting is, of course, wow, if the birds are doing it and the bees are doing it and the flowers are doing it, then there must be something there, mm-hmm. right? So that's worth looking at. But then the more you're familiar with the patterns, then when you see an anomaly, you go, whoa. What is that frog doing in the desert? Right? Mm-hmm. Like there, and so then we look at those as champion adapters and say, well, what's your magic trick? Because every other frog I know lives where it's wet, and it is not wet here. So you must have a really cool trick up your sleeve. How do you do it? Right? So function gets you also, like, it develops a lens in which you can discover so many fascinating things from the natural world.
I love that perspective, and thank you for bringing that up, because it's a perfect segue. It is such a beautiful perspective to have once you start practicing biomimicry. The way in which I viewed the world, in which I lived, in which I communicated, in which I wanted to learn, and what the direction my entire career took is like totally changed based on this practice of learning from, observing, and being curious about the natural world. So thank you for that and for helping to spread this, because it's truly life-changing.
Oh, thanks, Lily.
And speaking of life-changing and all fun things, what is giving you hope right now?
Let's see. Well, there's a lot of things. One is the world is finally ready, right? So there was something about the pandemic, I think, that caused people to slow down and go, you know what? This trajectory we're on, it's not working. Like a whole set of people. So, I mean, we tripled our staff since before the pandemic. You know, so the world is knocking, right?
Yeah.
I went to the World Expo in Dubai, and over and over and over again, I saw two things in so many different country exhibits. One was, it was actually a dedication to nature. It was very clearly not like, hey, look at our national parks, come visit, but we have this treasure. And we have this treasure not just as something to observe from a distance or to, you know, to take from, to harvest, but we have this treasure that is in its own right a treasure. I saw it over and over again. Poland's exhibit was called Inspired by Nature. New Zealand was talking about giving rights to rivers, right? I mean, you saw it over and over again. And then the other thing, they were all featuring how the young, you know, the young inventors in their 20s in their country were like, nope, I'm doing the sustainability thing and I'm taking inspiration from my country, my nature, for what solves and what do we need here. And so it was such a beautiful, and of course, yes, these are showcases and all of that, but I'm seeing the examples over and over and over again. And for me, it's the generation that is entering the workforce right now, as well as the generation that is starting to come into power in the workplace, that seems committed not to power, not to extreme capitalism, not to, you know, winner takes all, but wait a minute, you know, we live in an interconnected and interdependent world. I think we need to start doing things differently. And so all of that gives me a ton of hope. We got work to do, no question. But I'm seeing a lot of good signs.
Yeah.
A lot of good signs.
We're ready and the time is now. And I think you have a unique perspective too, because you have been in this field for quite a number of years and have seen it, you know, face a lot of hurdles. And to have to hear you say that, I think is really hopeful too, because I'm so new to this field too. You know, it's been only 5 or 6 years and I'm seeing the doors open as well. And that's really powerful. But to have you say that, I think is extra powerful because you've seen a lot of these hurdles firsthand.
Yeah. 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 And I'm seeing it more and more. And of course, you know, there's all of the, you know, the acronyms that are out there of, you know, the rights of nature and this and that, and, you know, it's showing up in COP and all these things. And I take a global perspective.
Right.
And it's happening in so many places. And quite frankly, I don't care if it's happening because you're pressured from the outside or it comes from the inside.
Exactly.
You gotta do it differently if you want to continue to exist. And we're seeing that. With some really big names, which is fantastic.
That's amazing. Okay, last question. Do you have any favorite resources to share with folks who are either just starting out their biomimicry journey or are in their biomimicry journey and need a boost of inspiration?
Well, if you're just starting out, just go outside, right? Like find your nearest living non-human thing, whether it's the little herb garden outside your window or your backyard or your nearest park, and just have this function lens, have this like, what is this thing doing in your mind? It's so much more accessible than you might think. You don't have to be in some fantastic, spectacular, wild place. Life is like growing through the cracks in the concrete, and that is really cool. Watch, mm-hmm. just check out the cracks in the concrete. So definitely for those starting up, and then, you know, those that are just heading out, I think probably the best advice I can give you is to close the computer, right? Like, turn the frickin' screen off, and don't even bring the phone. You know, don't even bring the phone. It's not about taking the picture. It's just like you and outside and curiosity. That's really the only ingredient that you need to bring, and challenge yourself to find something that brings you delight every day. Hmm.
Thank you, Dana. That was amazing. And I really appreciate your time.
So grateful to be here. And thank you, Lily, for your great work and spreading this word. It's been wonderful to work with you over the years, and I'm so excited to see where you take this next.
I hope that conversation brought you just as much joy as it did me. I'm going to close us out today with one of my favorite quotes from Dana's book, The Biomimicry Resource Handbook. Beauty is a large part of why biomimicry resonates. Our search for mentors brings us back into contact with the living world, a place where we were tuned to appreciate. Having spent 99.9% of our planetary tenure woven deep into the wild, we humans naturally admire the weaver bird's nest, the conscious shell, the scales of a shimmering trout. In fact, there are few things more beautiful to the human soul than good design. When it is good in all aspects, stirring to the senses, fit for its function, elegant in its material choice, and gentle in its manufacture, we can't help but feel delight and the desire to do at least as well in our next design. That's what biomimics feel each time they see a swift, slice blue sky or a butterfly float to a flower in full bloom, a desire to be more like the organisms we admire.